Righty ho. Okay, tēnā koutou, good evening and welcome. My name is Lucinda Thatcher and I am your host this evening for our webinar on clinician wellbeing. Our session this evening is run by the University of Otago Section of Rural Health and the Division of Rural Hospital Medicine within the Rural New Zealand College of General Practitioners. It has been endorsed for 1 hour of CME, and if you complete our feedback form at the end and add your medical council number, I will upload the points for you. So hopefully it won't be as chaotic as last time and I'll have a little bit more success with your feedback form. Our speaker this evening is Jo Cole, an emergency physician based in Tauranga. She's a mother of three busy boys and a true promoter of clinician wellbeing. This evening we're going to explore factors that impact on clinician wellbeing and we look forward to any questions and your input this evening. So I'll hand over to you, Jo, and we'll go from there.
Hi everybody, thanks very much for having me, especially to Lucinda for inviting me. It was great to meet those of you that were able to attend the conference back in August, I think it was, which was held locally. So for those that were there then, apologies for some repetition, but I think when it comes to wellbeing, I think we can't talk about this enough. So thanks everyone for making time on your busy evenings to come along tonight. I guess when we think about clinician wellbeing, the very first thing is to say, why are we talking about this? That's quite different to the topics that are normally discussed in medical webinars and college webinars. And I guess from my perspective, this whakatauke really sums it up as to why this is a really important thing to be discussing. The people at the heart of all that we do. And it's not rocket science to know that if we're not well as clinicians, then our ability to care for our patients and to really enjoy and have fulfilled work lives is really, really difficult. So when we put the people in the centre rather than just the patients in the centre, when we think about clinician wellbeing as alongside our patient wellbeing, then I think we've got a much better hope for the future of medicine. I meant to say a few caveats before I started, actually, that I talk really fast and Lucinda may interrupt at any moment to remind me to slow down. And also I often talk like a stream of consciousness, especially when I'm really passionate about things like wellbeing. And so she may also interrupt my stream of consciousness and redirect me towards what's actually on the slide at any moment. But we know each other well, so that doesn't worry me at all.
No, we're going to have fun, I think. We'll have fun. At least make it interesting.
The other thing I would say is that I stand on the shoulder of giants when it comes to this work. I am by no means an expert at clinician wellbeing. I find the practice of remaining well a challenge all the time in the area that I work in, and I'm sure you guys find the same thing as well. And so what I'm talking about tonight is a combination of my own thoughts, lots of the research and work that's been done by other people in the field like Tate Shatterfelt and Sheree Johnson and the Mayo team and the Stanford team, as well as some sort of local factors that I think are really important. We might start first of all by talking about burnout itself. I think it's a word that has become so commonplace in medicine now. And if you look at any of the journals over the last few years, across every specialty from surgery, ophthalmology, pathology, psychiatry, you know, rural medicine, emergency medicine, peds, there's always a topic around burnout and clinician wellbeing across years with journals. And so it's not specific to any one specialty, and I think it's something which is at the front of mind for many people. But it's also a word that's kind of become so colloquially used that it's often hard to truly understand the definition, because we tend to say, oh, I feel a bit burnt out, or it's a bit burnt out, and we don't use it in necessarily in the way that it was truly designed. And so I thought we'd start by talking a little bit around the definitions for burnout itself. And I think it's really important to understand that burnout is an occupational syndrome, so it's not a mental health condition, even though it's often characterised in that way when it's discussed for individual clinicians. It's an occupational syndrome now recognised by WHO as being that, and it's a prolonged response to chronic unresolved workplace stresses. And I think that rings true for many of us now as we come close to our third COVID Christmas, that all of us in our workplaces are experiencing that kind of ongoing level of stress in our day-to-day work. But the syndrome of burnout itself is characterised by three main points, and that is a feeling of exhaustion, and not that kind of exhaustion where you just need a bit more sleep, but that physical, emotional, cognitive exhaustion where you really feel like you've got nothing left to give, when you really feel like you can't function the way that you want to at work and often at home as well. The second part is depersonalisation or cynicism, which I think when we look at ourselves and our colleagues, it's a really common thing to see in medicine. We use black humour a lot to try and sort of manage the day-to-day aspects of our work. But we also know that when we are colleagues or ourselves at a place where we're really struggling, that cynicism and that sense of complete disconnection from the joy of work, disconnection from the humanity of your patients and your colleagues comes to the forefront. And the third part is their sense of a low sense of professional efficacy, which means, I don't know, I think an easy way of just saying is that you just feel like you really aren't good at your job anymore, or you can't do the job that you want to do, and you're not getting a sense of being effective at work and being passionate about your job anymore. And that's a definition that was set up by Christina Maslach back in the 1970s, and it's kind of been stuck since then as the main definition that we use for burnout. And burnout can occur in sort of three different domains. We see that when, especially when it's measured, when we look at the Copenhagen Burnout Industry Inventory, rather, or the Maslach Inventory, which are the two common measures of burnout that you see when you look at studies. In fact, most of you will have answered a survey probably in the last few years that involve those questions. It really looks at three different domains. One is the sense of personal burnout, where you really feel that physical and psychological fatigue and exhaustion experienced by working in healthcare or working whatever field you work in. And then there's a work-related burnout where you really feel like it's connected purely as being related to work, rather than it being that global sense of personal burnout that you have. And the patient-related burnout, which is how much of your burnout is related to your actual day-to-day contact with patients. And I think it's really important to note that for most people who are experiencing burnout, it's rare that patient-related burnout is the main focus. So we'll give and give and give, and the last thing to go is our patients. And often those moments of connection with your patients are the things that maintain your joy in the workplace. And it's the paperwork and the systems and the inefficiencies and the lack of autonomy that actually creates burnout in other ways. Some of you will have answered the ASMS burnout surveys that ran in 2015 and again at the beginning of COVID in 2020. And this is the data specific to rural hospital medicine, which shows that the rates of burnout within your specialty are very similar to the rates of burnout within my specialty and many specialties within acute medicine. And that's at least 50% of us as clinicians are experiencing burnout at any one time. So the numbers are really, really big. You flip a coin over the people that you know in your specialty, and 50% of us will have at one time experienced burnout or experiencing it currently. It's important to compare the data across the 5-year period between 2015 and 2020. And note that it's just the work-related burnout is just generally creeping up. We know that across all specialties, unfortunately, female physicians between the ages of 40 to 49 generally have higher rates of burnout than male doctors. But what we're seeing now more is that rates of burnout in men who are also parents is becoming much higher as well. And I think that speaks to how society has changed. And so that, you know, a generation or two ago, a male doctor perhaps was able to completely separate work and home. And they often had a wife at home that would do all those home-related tasks, and they could purely concentrate on their career without much interference, so to speak. Whereas now we want our husbands and fathers and partners to be engaged, and our male doctors want to be engaged in that as well, but that creates additional pressure for them, leading to increased rates of burnout. I'll note that if you look down here for rural hospital medicine specialists, the rates of patient-related burnout is probably a bit higher than other specialties. Often in other specialties, or when you look across a larger group of mixed specialties, it's often well under 20% that people would relate to patient-related burnout. So that's something interesting to think as a specialty, to think, how is it different for us? Is it the nature of the close communities that we work in? Are there other aspects that mean that patient-related burnout is higher? But I think the other thing is we're very black and white in medicine. We tend to have things of right or wrong. The answer is right, yes or no. But burnout and well-being are not sort of black and white. You're not well or burnt out. There's a huge continuum across that. I think that's a really important thing to think about as well. This sort of wellbeing continuum has been designed by a psychologist who works almost exclusively with Doctors for Wellbeing Work in Australia now, called Sheree Johnson. And she describes this wellbeing continuum as going from burnt out to flowing and all those states in between. And I think that when we talk about these states in between, I think they'll resonate with many people currently. So though we might understand what burnt out is from a true different definition sense, just before that is that sense of languishing, that sense of kind of complete lack of fulfillment of what you do, an emptiness around the sense of being a doctor or a clinician in healthcare today, and a sense of malaise that goes along with that. Surviving, I think, is a place where many of us have spent a lot of time probably. And I think especially we think about it for our trainees, how much time they spend sort of just surviving, just getting through the roster, getting through the next period of training. So you're coming to work, you're showing up, you're doing the best that you can, but you're not doing much more than just getting through the day-to-day. Coping is sort of one step closer to that, where, yeah, it's working okay. You feel like you're actually getting things done. You feel like you're achieving some things. You've got a sense of purpose. But you have a sense that actually you could be that step further, which is flourishing, which I think is as you know, a state that we'd all love to be in. I think that hopefully that lots of us have experienced it at times, but flourishing in our current healthcare system, if we're honest, it's really tricky at the moment with the pressures that we face. So that sense of truly being fulfilled in what you do, really feeling like you're in an environment which is supporting you to grow, that you really feel you have to bring your whole self to work. So you're really, really kind of three-dimensional rather than this kind of, I'm a doctor and nothing else and everything else is left at the front door. And I think that's ideally where we want to be. Is up in that flourishing state, recognizing that things come and go, life changes, the stresses outside of work change just as much, and you'll move up and down this continuum. But having a sense of awareness of where you are, and I thought to stop myself talking too quickly for, we would actually just stop for just 30 seconds and just think for a moment, if you look at this continuum, where are you now currently for yourself? Don't worry, we're not going to ask you to put in the chat. It's just a personal reflection on where you sit currently.
Very rhetorical question. But maybe once you've hopefully learnt some stuff after today, then in a couple of weeks' time, you can, or a couple of months, you can look at where you might would then be on the wellbeing continuum.
So just putting that in your mind as a point of reflection for yourself, thinking about those things which drive clinician burnout, these points here, I think, it's important to think about both the organisational factors that increase clinician burnout, but also the things which are us as people, which actually make us more prone to burnout as well. And this is pretty consistent across all international research. This is not New Zealand specific data, it's not specialty specific. All the large international studies looking at clinician burnout all come up with the same factors. And I think they really resonate with most of us. And as you'll see when we show Lucinda's Mentimeter slide, this really fits with that. So those drivers where you don't have control of your workload, the workload is excessive. Often you're dealing with really inefficient IT systems or processes which just take so much time during the day. You don't feel like you've got control of your working day. Sadly, certainly in many of the organisations and DHBs that I've worked in, instability and conflict between clinicians is a really big factor. We imagine when we're training that it's going to be the clinical medicine, which is going to be really tough as consultants, but frequently it's the non-clinical interactions, it's all the additional things to cause more stress for people than the clinical medicine itself. You'll often find when we talk about values conflict, I think that's a big thing for us at the moment, when we think about moral injury and the idea that one of our values is always to, you know, to give as much as we can and do the best that we can. The system often doesn't allow us to do that currently, which is a real driver for burnout at the moment, I think, as well. And for people that move around, whether that be because you work in a very small community or you work in a isolated practice, or perhaps you're moving around for training, that lack community or the inability to develop a consistent community is a really important factor as well.
Yeah.
But from an individual perspective, I think it's also really important to remember that the reality is that we're a pre-selected bunch of people that come into healthcare, especially into medicine. And generally speaking, we are closer to the type A end of the spectrum. We're highly driven, often have perfectionistic traits which make it hard to ask for help, make it hard to accept that actually there'll be times when we don't succeed or where times where things don't go like we want them to do. Our ability to create connection and community has changed where we live, how we train. And also there's always been, has been for generations, a real stigma around the idea of clinicians saying, I'm struggling, I need help. So stigma and shame can be a real issue for clinicians to ask for help, even though we know burnout is in fact an occupational syndrome and not actually to do with an individual's mental health. And why does it matter? I think this is a thing which, I mean, if you've been talking to anybody in management about clinician wellbeing, these are really important factors to keep in your mind and to use as your sort of real pressure points. It is expensive. If you're thinking about it from a dollar perspective for an organisation or for a quality perspective, we know that clinicians who are burnt out or experiencing signs of burnout are much more likely to make error. The quality of care will go down. You know, you're not as efficient if you're not feeling well. You're much more likely to have interpersonal conflict because you've just got nothing left to give. And you're much more likely to become disengaged. And we're seeing that a lot within healthcare currently. And I think that's across the world in lots of specialties, the idea of lots of industries, the idea of quiet quitting, just disengaging, do the bare minimum and nothing else, or in specialties that have the opportunity for private, going out of the public system into private. More importantly, from an individual perspective, we know that clinician burnout, it's really closely linked to relationship difficulties. So it's not isolated just the workplace. The ramifications just ripple out across all the people that are most important to us in our lives. We know it's really closely linked to substance abuse and misuse. And though burnout itself is not a mental health disorder, we know that clinicians experiencing burnout are much more likely to then develop depression, anxiety, and mental health concerns. And we know sadly that it's linked to physician suicide. And I certainly, within our specialty, I can think of at least five people in the last sort of 5 to 10 years who have committed suicide. And there's a multitude of factors of why that has happened, but certainly workplace stress has contributed to that as well. And we know that people are leaving medicine because they're burnt out, and we actually can't afford for anybody to leave medicine currently because there's not enough of us.
No.
So I think it's sort of a new thing for people to be concerned about clinician wellbeing. This slide refers to how the Mayo Clinic, who are sort of the leaders and one of the leaders in clinician wellbeing work across the world, but they described the idea of the era of distress, which was a couple of decades ago, where really doctors were isolated. There was no discussion about individual wellbeing. They're expected to be almost hero-like, I guess, and the idea that you didn't show that you didn't have needs, your own personal needs, just had how you did your job. And in the last decade or so, there's really been the shift towards recognising in organisations that clinician wellbeing is really important. That's wellbeing 1.0. And that's really been on the idea of, okay, we need to manage wellbeing for clinicians, because if we don't keep our clinicians well, especially from an American perspective, then the quality of care goes down, the costs rise. And so that's why we should focus on wellbeing work. And recognition of what causes issues around clinician wellbeing as well. But the focus then on the solutions has been very much individualised. So if we were in a room together and I said to you, put your hand up, if your organisation currently offers resiliency workshops, yoga at lunchtime, mindfulness training, most people will put their hands up. And if you work in the NHS, it's even worse, where there's mandatory modules on sleep hygiene and wellbeing for doctors, which is the antithesis of wellbeing, I think. And so the focus has very much been, even though we know that, take burnout, for example, that's an occupational syndrome, the focus has been very much on, if you're not well, then clinician, heal thyself. That if we all practice enough mindfulness, if we attend yoga classes, if we attend resiliency workshops, that that will cure the systemic epidemic, essentially, of clinician burnout and clinician ill health. The main issue with that is not that the issue around yoga and resiliency training, because personally, as Lucinda and I have both bonded over, I think that there's a huge amount of benefit to be gained from breathwork, mindfulness, yoga practice, or, you know, any kind of physical body practice, which really gets you out of your head and out into the physical environment and out into really looking after yourself. But when we make it all about the clinician as an individual and suggest that if someone is burnt out, then they just need to do more for themselves, and we make it all about the idea of self-care, it really puts a focus on the fact that there's something wrong with the clinician, that in fact it's their fault they've got to this state, and so therefore they just need to do some more work in themselves and things will get better. And the reality is that something's such a tiny part of the picture. And it's really stigmatising and often quite shaming for clinicians who then find themselves burnt out because they're left in this idea that it really is something they need to have done better. So once again, it's the idea of I need to be better rather than actually the system needs to support me to be able to be the best that I can be at work. And I guess this is one of my favourite sayings, and that is the idea that the answer to burnout is not us being stronger canaries. So if we've got 50% of clinicians currently burnt out, and that is literally, you know, worldwide almost, if 50% of clinicians are burnt out, we don't need us to be stronger. There is fundamentally something wrong with the system that in which we're engaging in. So if the canaries keep dying or falling over, you don't ask for stronger canaries. You ask what's the problem with the gold mine. And I think the reality is that when we look at much of the research, that about 80% of the issues, or 80% of the contributing factors for burnout or issues around clinician wellbeing are systems-based issues or organisational issues. And only about 20% is around a particular individual clinician need. And so when we focus only on that 20%, we're bringing people back into the environment which hasn't changed at all. And so you're asking people to, often the solution is to take some time off, and you come back into the exactly the same environment with all the same stresses you had before. And then if the same thing happens again, it's even more stigmatising for the clinician who feels that they haven't succeeded because they again quite have failed. But in fact, what's happened is they've been put back into the gold mine, and it remains just as toxic for them as it was the first time they left the gold mine, so to speak. So where do we go then? So if this is only sort of part of the answer, if we sort of start to think about clinician wellbeing, but we've only got sort of part of the way there, what is the next step? And the next step is getting into what we call wellbeing 2.0. So it's really looking at wellbeing from a different perspective. It's the idea of taking away from the idea of patient-centred care into people-centred care. It's focusing on the needs of all the people in the system, the patients and the clinicians side by side, and trying to find solutions to actually make it manageable for both, rather than putting the focus on one or the other. It's about the idea of really listening to clinicians, about finding ways that we can change the system to allow for more autonomy, flexibility, and to really invest in people and invest in clinicians, knowing that if the system invests in us, if the organisations invest in us as clinicians, that actually we will give back tenfold, because that's mostly the nature of who we are. But how do we get there? And I often think, if it was easy, we wouldn't be talking about it tonight. If it was easy, there wouldn't be like thousands of journal articles written about it. If it was easy, there wouldn't be 15 books that have been released in the last 2 years all about burnout. But I think the very first place to start is awareness, and that's what tonight's really about. It's about creating awareness. It's about opening those lines of discussion. It's about sharing ideas. And it's about us becoming advocates for one another and advocates for wellbeing within the system. And then from there, we move into the idea of what actions can we take and where do we go from here? Acknowledging that we're at the very beginning of a very long road and we don't have any solutions that are going to magically change things overnight, just like we don't have any magical solutions for how we're going to transform our healthcare system and patient experiencing from that perspective either. But I would say the very first thing to do is to start by listening to clinicians. And we did a burnout study in our DHB, myself and a psychiatrist and a psychologist, did a SMO burnout study back in August 2020. And we got quite detailed answers from about 240 SMOs across Tauranga and Whakatane Hospital. They did the Copenhagen burnout inventory and got data very, very similar to the other data and rates of burnout. But we also asked them specifically, what are the drivers? So what are the things that prevent you from being well at work? What are the things that really, you know, drive you mental? What are the things that you feel are preventing you from doing the job that you want to do? And then the flip side of that, we also asked them, what are the solutions? So what works well for you? And what we found from that data, with really, really great qualitative data that we got from the SMOs, was that the drivers of burnout are just the other side of the coin to the solutions. So the teams that said to us, lots of people said, there's not an FDE, I don't have enough admin support, IT is driving me crazy, I can't get enough theatre time, whatever it may be, depending on the specialty was. And the flip side of people that told us really positive experiences were, we've got a fantastically engaged team, my admin scheduler is amazing, our team, you know, actually meets outside of work and we find that really bonding, or I got it. There's lots of other things. And so the answers are the same. The answers are held within all of us as clinicians. But frequently the right questions aren't asked, or they're asked, but they ask the questions, but then we don't take any action afterwards. Lucinda asked you guys to fill in a little Mentimeter question before you came along tonight. And this is the word cloud that was created by your answers. And I think that it's a good time to look at that too now. So when we asking the same kind of question, what is the barriers to you flourishing at work currently? And you can see that the number one factor for everybody that answered this question was paperwork. And from that, I would take that to be an inefficiency, reams and reams of paperwork that seem to have no point, or that actually affect your ability to actually engage with patients one-on-one. But you look at all the way through there, many of the same things have come up that we would have seen in our data as well. So staffing, unrealistic expectations, workload too high, systems that don't support you, a little bit around patients, what else have we got there? Intersocial hours, staff turnover.
There's a little bit around the conflict, you know, in terms of bullying and things. Mm. But it's interesting how it doesn't pick up on the similar wording, isn't it? Because if you look at them, a lot of them are very repetitive, like a lot around the staffing and things. But, you know, there's the failure to address issues, deafening silence from leaders, deafening silence, you know, a sense that we just haven't been listened to, I think, or understood. Indifference is another word.
Management comes up almost quite a large word there, which I assume that means interactions with people that are in non-clinical roles that are seen to have control of things that we can't control. Time, we're all time poor.
Which I'm sure is contributed to by the paperwork. There's one in there about age.
I think that's one of the things which is really important to consider, which we might talk about a bit later as well, is that we haven't built our systems to allow us to flourish across a working life, which is different from the beginning when you first start training different if you've got different stages of your family life. And then actually, how do we actually design and job craft our careers? So take us through that last 10, 20 years. What do we want and what are our needs? And how do we change rosters to accommodate for those kind of changes in life as well?
I did have to Google epistemic. Did you
see that looking at that before and I thought, what does that mean?
There's someone with really good vocabulary. If the person who wrote epistemic is on here, they could put it in the chat. But my Google came up with knowledge, I think. My Google wasn't uber helpful on that, but I thought that was awesome. Anyway, everyone needs to find out what epistemic means. Perfect. So yeah, that's really interesting. And I can send it through to everyone, but that is a Mentimeter and you can just log in, create a web page, and then you can do that same thing at your work and find out what the issues are, then find out the solutions and you'll put the words in and it pops up like that. And it's really quite neat to see and a great way to interact with each other.
We did a similar one a few years ago. We did it and then Anna set to it to us around the idea of the IHI, so the Institute of Healthcare Improvement Joy and Work Project, and you do a similar kind of thing, what provides joy and work. And I went up to the NSF department one day to catch up with somebody and they had this displayed in a large poster on the wall, and can anybody guess what the major word in the middle of the NSF bring joy and work was?
Anaesthetised patient?
No. Organised. Which made me laugh as an ED physician, because obviously our work day is not organised or in control. But the most important thing was organised.
Nice.
So it reminds you that I think it's an important reminder of, you know, everybody has different needs for what they need. Everybody
different
has different
personalities.
In your workplaces. Yeah.
For sure.
So getting back to the prospect of Wellbeing 2.0, I think to this model here, which may or may not be familiar to people, but this is what we call the Stanford model of professional fulfillment. So this is a model which has been created by the Stanford WellMD program, which is a very large program in the States in Stanford, dedicated purely to clinician wellbeing, and they run wellbeing director courses, and one of which I did just recently, and other things. And there's lots of resources online you can get from them as well. I like this, not so much because of the words are a little bit American, but I like the idea that it actually suggests that we actually need different parts of the circle to come together. So I guess professional fulfillment for me is more the idea of what does it mean, what do I need to be well, what do I need to bring my whole self to work, and what do I need to actually know that I'm actually doing the job that I want to do, and actually coming home with some space and energy and that kind of thing. And I guess Wellbeing 1.0 kind of sat right down here. So it was very much, okay, well, if we don't want to look at clinician wellbeing, we should really focus on actually making our doctors more resilient. So that's part of it. So we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. That's definitely important. But we can't, as Tate Jennifer says, we can't resilience our way out of this thing. So the complex health system that we work in now and the complexity of our lives outside of medicine as well, resiliency alone is not going to get us through this. We need it. We need our resiliency skills. We need to look at our own personal ways of staying well. But that's only part of the picture. And naturally, doctors are pretty resilient to get through training to start with anyway. The other two parts of the circle, I think, are really, really important. And that's, I guess, where we'll probably spend more of the time talking about now. And that's two aspects. One is actually existing in an organisation or a workplace where there is a real culture of wellness. And we're not talking about, you know, chocolate in the tea room and a fruit basket. We're not talking about a Christmas card, you know, that kind of thing. We're talking about existing in a group of people or a team, even if it's just your small team in a whole organisation, which really, really focuses on creating a workplace where wellbeing is prioritised. And that means things like rostering, access to leave, ensuring that people are given the opportunity to focus on things outside of medicine as well as in medicine, and really creating a sense of connection and belonging in the workplace, which is incredibly important. And then the other part of that is the idea of, it's a very American term, efficiency of practice. But from my perspective, it means making it easy to do our jobs. So what needs to change to make it easy to do our job? So if you think back to that word cloud that we looked at just before, if there was something which we could fundamentally change for rural medicine practitioners, paperwork seems to be the major thing. Like, what could happen to reduce the volume of paperwork that's done? What could happen to make Lucinda's inbox bane of your life more manageable? And are there things that could happen to change that? Because that's much more likely to have a significant impact on Lucinda's wellbeing than a resiliency workshop. Because fundamentally, she is pretty awesome at looking after herself outside of medicine, but it's the things that day-to-day affect your wellbeing at work that are equally important. Before we stop talking about self-care and personal, really personalised wellbeing, I think this is one thing which I would really open your minds to as well. And that's coming from this book here, which I would recommend, and we'll put it at the end, which is a book written by Cherie Johnson, who is a psychologist who works purely with doctors and focuses now purely on clinician wellbeing. And this is a fantastic book, which really summarizes a lot of the research in a really, really easy readable way, and lots of practical advice on how on clinician wellbeing. But she very much talks about the idea of the self-care skills that we need as clinicians, and not the ability to, you know, sleep, nutrition, exercise are incredibly important, but we as medical professionals know that already. We just need to put that into practice. We don't have a positive knowledge around that. But it's not just those things that are going to make a difference for self-care. And really, when we think about self-care in a broader sense, the self-care skills that we need as clinicians are those interpersonal skills. So I think emotional intelligence is incredibly important. Self-awareness, self-compassion, using mindfulness as a tool. But emotional intelligence, you kind of wish they'd talk to us about that at med school. I feel like we're kind of catching up on those things now. And then interpersonal skills, learning about those things and practicing those things and being engaged in those things really early on, that allows us to improve our communication, to really focus on collaboration, and to look at leadership skills as well. Because most of the stress that is in the workplace, like we talked about before, is based around those interpersonal conflicts or the interpersonal differences between different people in the organisation. And so keeping well and self-care can actually involve way more than what we would traditionally think of as the popular version of self-care. This is the thing that I think is really important, the concept of what's within our circle of control. Because when you start to think about changing wellbeing for clinicians in your organisation or, you know, across the whole country, then it can feel quite overwhelming, because we are so much of our cognitive bandwidth and emotional bandwidth has been used up already by our day-to-day jobs and by our lives outside of medicine. And so when you start to think about adding one more thing, and it can feel like, well, what can I do? I'm one person in an organisation, I'm one person on a team, or I can't control what's happening with the college, I can't control what's happening with Te Whatu Ora. So I think it's a good time to think about what is in our control. And as SMOs, for those of us that are SMOs, we actually do have a whole lot more control and autonomy than we realise, and despite the fact that we like to say it's the system's fault or talk about they, in the sense that this is this nebulous sense of people outside of us. But it's really important, I think, to think about Stephen Covey's work with the idea of what's in your circle of control. What can I change today? Or what can I control today? And then the circle of influence, what influence do I have to make changes or to encourage others in that space? And then what, recognising things that, these are the things that we might be concerned about, worried about, but we have no control over that. And so not exerting too much energy on those things that are out of our circle of influence and control. And I think the same things, I quite like the idea of looking at where we sit as ourselves, where we sit with a team, where does that organisation sit within that, and where does the system sit within that as well. And I know certainly with everything that's happening with Te Whatu Ora at the moment, I've got no control over that as an emergency physician. And I could spend lots of time worrying about what's going to happen in a year's time with Te Whatu Ora, what's going to happen with all the different IT systems, what's going to happen with how we move patients around, all those kind of things. But I have no control over that. And so I've mentally decided I can't have any bandwidth for that. And I'm going to focus on what I can do in our organisation, in our team, and for myself. And I think most of us have the biggest ability to affect positive change within our teams. Some people might be in a position where they're in the organisation where they can affect more influence and positive change in the wider system. But if we start small and start just with the team around us, then we're going to get the most positive and, I think, beneficial change together. So we're going to talk now more about the idea of how we can work together as teams to improve our workplace wellbeing, or things that might be useful. I'm not sure if anyone's seen this before, but this is the concept of the idea of what are the core needs for us to be well in the workplace. And this can apply across an entire organisation's workforce. So this isn't specific to doctors, it's not specific to nurses, it's not specific to allied health. The same thing can be applied for our admin teams as well. So, and that's the concept that everybody needs some autonomy over their workplace. So ideally, we want to work in environments where there is fairness, where there's justice, where we feel empowered to make decisions. And that can be quite difficult in medicine, especially depending on where you sit in the hierarchy, because often we don't have control of our rosters. We don't have control over some of the sense of fairness and justice and how things happen within an organisation and what gets funded and what doesn't. But having something within your workplace that you feel you've got some positive control over is really important. A sense of belonging is fundamental to any workplace, and we know that a sense of strong connection and belonging to an organisation or to a team is going to reduce staff turnover, it's going to improve wellbeing, And it's going to generally improve the way teams work together, both with patients and together. And then the third part of sort of those core needs is the idea of contribution. And that, I think, is incredibly important and often forgotten because you get so used to what you do in medicine, it becomes second nature. So you forget that everything that we're doing in medicine is often, almost everything's in the service of others. And we're contributing on a day-to-day basis, but you just forget that because you get so tied up in all the additional work that you're doing, that taking those moments to recognise your own contribution, recognise the contribution of your team, can sort of get lost in the mix, I guess. And we forget that, you know, we contribute in so many other ways with education, with our teams, with med students or nursing students or paramedic students. There's so many different opportunities to provide additional contribution in our communities. You know, who hasn't been to a kindy talk or helped out at school camp with your little medical hat on as well? Efficiency of practice is the other, we talked about before, about making it easier to do our jobs. And I think that's another thing that is important to think about in teams as well. So what are the things that we could do in our teams, that you could do in your team at work, that would make it easier to do your job or make it easier for someone else in your team to do their job? And mostly the answers are within your team. So I often think, like, if I asked any of our admin team in ED, can you think of something that you could do that would make it fundamentally easier to your job? They could tell me five or six things. Or are there things that you do that there's really no point? Are you filling in paperwork that there is literally no point in that being filled in because no one's going to read it after you filled in? It's going to get filed and no one's ever going to see it again. What would you change in your day to make it easier to do your job or to make it more efficient to do your job? And the answers are usually held within the team that are doing the job themselves. And these are some of the things which you might want to look into. It's so common that efficiency of practice is difficult. It's so common that people are doing stuff, they just think, why am I doing this? That actually whole modules have been made and whole campaigns have been made. There's one through the IHI, which you can look up, called Breaking Rules for Better Care. So it's basically, there's a stupid rule that's been invented, a protocol that's no one's read that you've got to follow. What would you do? How would you break the rules? So Break the Rules for Better Care. The American version of that is getting rid of stupid stuff, specifically around the IT issues with the EMR. But the idea of what would you get rid of tomorrow? So if you have to, you know, fill on 5 bits of paper, which is to get one thing, or if you've got to do 6 clicks on the IT system to make one single referral, how could we change that? Let's get rid of the stupid stuff that actually frustrates people day to day. Because that fundamentally would actually change people's wellbeing. And if you look them up, you can see there's campaigns for both of these things. There's a really lovely positive social movement in the NHS called the 15 seconds for 30 minutes, which you could literally start tomorrow and wherever you work. And that's a concept of creating more joy in work. But is there a task that would take you 15 seconds to do and would save someone 30 minutes when they look for something? So often it's around equipment. So, you know, it's someone's used the last of the otoscope covers and you go into the room to your same room, you're like, oh, I can't find it, but to go around searching, finding for it. But if someone's just replaced it at the time, someone's moved the ultrasound machine, doesn't put it back where it belongs, all those kind of little things. Or it might be, I often think it's the fact that if I do a task that someone's really struggling with that I've done a million times, it's way easier for me to do it. And that's going to save them time and they can do something else. So where's your skill set? How can you help out? And being aware of when other people need that support.
Like it.
The other part that's really important from a workplace wellbeing perspective, I think, is the concept of meaning and purpose at work, which ties back into that idea of that sense of contribution, which is the fundamental workplace need. But there's pretty good evidence now, I call it the 80-20 rule, that clinicians who can spend at least 20% of their time engaged in work which they feel is really meaningful, they'll have a lower risk of burnout. So you don't need your whole job to be perfect, but you need a portion of it to really feel like it's bringing you joy, to really feel like you've got true meaning in it, to really connect back to why you do medicine or why you do whatever aspect of healthcare that you're doing, to really help to engage and reduce your risk of burnout. And for some people, that's clinical work. For other people, it might be teaching. It might be the opportunity to get out in their community and do some work, which is connected to their workplace as well. It might be looking at equity. So it might be that actually it's not your clinical work, it's the ability to make really positive change and engage from an equity perspective where you work. It could be wellbeing work. It could be simulation work. It could be any aspect of it. But can you find a way in your workplace to give yourself 20% where you think, this is why I love this job? And if you've got someone in your workplace that is having a really difficult time and feels like they're disengaged or feel you think is currently experiencing burnout, can you help them find something? Can you help them craft their day so that they get that every week? And sometimes it just takes some time thinking about it. So really thinking about what does it, you know, taking that time to just sit and think, what is it that matters most to me in medicine? What is it that I want to do more of? And how do I make that happen? I might not be able to change things tomorrow, but over the next year, how can I work my way towards getting something, some time in my day or some time across this year that's really going to allow me to focus on that? But you got to know what it is first. And lots of people go, it's just the patients, it's just the clinical medicine. But generally speaking, you've got to hone it down to finer than that, to what you really love.
That can be a really good question when people have to do their peer review or their PDPs or their questions with their supervisor, couldn't it? To actually discuss that and board plan going forward or in their careers or, as you say, in a tough time.
Mm. And I think that we've got to be realistic that all of these things take time to change. And so nothing's going to be overnight. But I think having someone else in your workplace or within your team or even remotely that you can talk about these things with, and that you can say, like, this is what I really want to do. How could I craft that for myself? Or that can support and actually motivate you to keep moving towards that. Or maybe someone that you've seen is doing something, do you think, oh, I want to do that too. How do I do that?
Yeah, nice.
When we think about the idea of workplace wellbeing as a team, I think fundamentally that connection and community in the workplace is one of the most important aspects. And I think if we could all, you know, I think if we could take it up to our Māori lens and basically embed that into all of our workplaces and really use some of the values that we see so prominently displayed and embodied and lived into our Māori, then we would fundamentally have workplaces and teams that truly gave a sense of connection and community at work. And I think that's something that we've really tried to focus on with our team as well. And that's really that sense of whanaungatanga. So really embedded that sense of relationships and connections and really focus on, you know, manaakitanga for us in our organisation. It's one of our, you know, workplace on the wall values for the whole organisation. But you want to take it off the wall and make a lived experience for your team. Because you know that if we did it to each other, we're going to give it back to our patients. And that fundamentally is most important. We're really lucky in ED, I guess, because we have that real sense of kotahitanga all the time. So you're always in it together. Like, we're a workforce that is always together. It's not a question of coming and going from a ward. Our doctors, our nurses, our admin team, our allied health team are literally working in the same space all the time, day and night. And so I think that gives us a real sense of togetherness and teamwork, which I think we, even on our hard days, are really fortunate for.
Hmm.
This is a little idea that we started doing for whakawhanaungatanga with our team in ED about a couple of years ago now. And I got the idea out of a social care network in the UK where they were using these ideas, these one-page profiles for patients who were in complex needs sitting in the community or patients with disabilities that were being cared for by care workers out in the community, about so that you get to know people. Oh, yeah. So they got to know one another. And I sort of adapted this for the workplace because I think it's a lovely way to introduce new team members to the team. And it's also a lovely way to get to know one another as a whole person. So rather than just, this is Bree, who's our nurse who's working in recess today, I want to know, so what matters to Bree most? And I also want to know, importantly, that last question at the end is, how do we support one another when it's tough? So I want to know in advance, ideally, for all of our team, what do people need? So if you can, if especially it's easier in smaller teams than in larger teams, but if you know how what someone needs, do they need to be on their own? Do they need a hug? Do they want a cup of tea? Do they want to just talk it through? But after a really big event or something which has been really distressing, if you can have those conversations beforehand, it's going to be easier to help afterwards. Obviously, favourite snacks is important for night shift where I work, but equally important for tea room snacks anywhere else. And I think it's it just helps to, I guess, really see ourselves as whole people. And I think it makes conversations much easier. And it's, you know, you love it when people will say to you, so what's happening with the boys currently? You want to be able to know what's important to somebody. One of our junior doctors recently, actually, if he wasn't in medicine, he wouldn't want to be a master chef. Someone else wanted to own a vineyard. So you start a conversation about what kind of wine would they want to grow, that kind of thing. So it just deepens that sense of connection in your teams. A little gap at the page is for a Polaroid camera picture. So everyone gets a Polaroid camera picture, and these pages go into like one of those flip charts, you know, clear files, and they sit in the tea room. So because we're quite a reasonably big department, so, well, small by an ED perspective, but bigger than most truly rural places.
We're going to do this at work too, because we did this at the workshop. And it was really fun, wasn't it? And it was interesting to see how many people had similar things on their bucket list. And, you know, it just created connections between people that you might not have never known. And as you say, it makes people or clinicians
I imagine you get all your admin staff and everyone to do it.
Yeah.
So as you say, you're actually people versus just workers, little beads on the line going in and out.
Yeah, a whole person rather than just what's on your name badge. So the other two aspects of team wellbeing that we've really focused on the last couple of years that I think is really useful as well is the concept of gratitude at work. And so really embedding gratitude practices in your workplace. And I think you'll see the post on the right describes lots of different ways that we use to express gratitude at work, mainly because there's no one size fits all. Some people, you know, we'll just come up and tell someone, other people like to use social media, but we've found lots of different ways because I think it, in our really, really busy days and our really stressed systems, it can be really easy to feel like you're just a worker bee that's going about your job and no one's noticed how hard you've worked. And it can be so uplifting to get the gratitude from someone. And so we'll use the virtual chocolate fish awards, a little peer-to-peer appreciation awards that you can send as an email to somebody, and it comes out like a little certificate, which is Lucinda wants to recognize Rory for his always being onto it with doing the feedback forms for the webinars, or we'll do, you know, like or it might be, you know, I'll send them to one of the orderlies, and one of the orderlies once said to me, he's like, oh my goodness, that was so amazing. It's the first certificate I've ever got. Can you help me print it out as a certificate? Because he'd never received a certificate for anything before. So it's amazing how much you can transform someone's day by being just expressing gratitude for little things. They're not having to be big things, they're little things.
I know, because the nurse sent me a message. We've got this announcement thing on our work one day about something I'd done. It was just like, oh, thanks for doing that. And honestly, it made my day. I felt so inspired to keep going for the rest of the day after someone just said thank you.
Yeah. And I think as Kiwis, we're not terribly good at receiving things. We're particularly bad at receiving praise, and you'll often just kind of brush it off. Someone will go, oh, thanks so much. Oh, yeah. And you brush it off. Mm. But for gratitude to really be effective, and for gratitude to grow, and for gratitude to really transform your well-being, you've got to kind of hold that and kind of like just, I guess, let that warmth sit with you. A bit like the idea of people from basking in the afterglow, the idea of you've got to sit with it and go, you know what, I did do that, or thank you, you know, that really does, and try and hold on to that for later. And the same with patients, I think. Often patients are expressing thanks to us and we're so busy that we just kind of go, yep, okay, thanks, and on to the next thing. But really taking that on board as well.
The afterglow.
Yeah. Great song. The other part of it is the concept of languages of appreciation at work. And I don't know how many people have read the original 1990s book, The Five Love Languages. Well, they wrote The Five Love Languages, and they wrote The Five Love Languages for children, I think. And then there's another book that's come out, which is called The Languages of Appreciation at Work, written by John Gray. They wrote the original book, and a guy called Chapman White, from memory. You don't need to read the whole book to get the general idea. If you read The Love Languages, it's very similar, just in a platonic workplace-based way. But I think it is really useful to think about the fact that everybody's different. So how we want to be appreciated is different for me than it is from Lucinda, that it is from Rory, from anybody else that's here. And also the way that you express appreciation might be different to how you actually want to receive appreciation. So this, I think, it's quite a kind of lighthearted way to talk about it as well. But the idea of talking to your teams about, you know, is it words of affirmation? Is it time? Is it acts of service? Is it a gift that you want to get? And the fifth thing, which I always like to talk to our journeys about as well, is physical touch, something that you want from an appreciation perspective. So hashtag hugger, hashtag not a hugger, really important after a big event or anything that you don't know whether people want to be hugged or not. Because some people just don't want a hug and other people actually are all over it. But knowing about those boundaries and workplaces is really important as well. But if we all knew what people want to do to be appreciated, then actually it means that we can really communicate and ensure that they're really receiving what they need in the workplace.
I know, because it's interesting that, because I would definitely, I think I would be a receiving hugger and I would probably be a giving hugger. And I asked people at work this, and there was a couple there who were like, absolutely not a hugger. Don't want a hug. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. Because you just kind of, you know, I don't know, I just thought, oh yeah, everyone would probably like a hug when they're, you know, feeling a bit down and tough. But no, a couple of definitely not a huggers.
And for some people, you know, that just the idea of, like I'm saying to them, do you want to go home 15 minutes early, is the best thing that you could do for them. Actually just being able to leave a little bit early is way more than a gift or a hug or words of appreciation. They just want to get home a bit earlier because stuff's happening at home. And so actually knowing that it's really important to them, that actually if they could just leave 15 minutes early, that's way more important than anything else. It's really important as well. So there's lots of different ways to kind of translate it in the workplace that are important, I think. I guess this is the, probably this is, we're coming to the end now, but this is one thing that I like to think about with anything to do with wellbeing work, because it can feel a bit like, well, I've got a long way to go and where do we start? And I've currently not got enough brain space to do my day-to-day job. I don't think I can fit the rest of this in. But I think one of the most important things to think about is the idea of the aggregation of marginal gains. I don't know if anyone has heard of this before, it's actually come out of the cycling world, but it's a concept that all our little things together, at the beginning, little 1% changes don't feel like much at all. But if you're adding together positive 1% changes, that you're going to end up with a much bigger aggregate of gains than you do them at the beginning when you just did that 1% change. So don't be disheartened by those little changes, because all those little changes will add up together. But equally, sorry, the same thing can happen. All those little 1% downward gains mean that actually you end up much, much further away from where you want to be than you thought you would be when you thought, oh, I'm just going to give that up for today, or I'm not going to focus on that. So I think that that concept of starting small and just incrementally doing things and doing things with the support of others is incredibly, incredibly important and will make the difference long term. We're kind of all in this for the long haul, and there's lots of uncertainty going forward, and we've faced heaps of uncertainty in the last 3 years nearly of COVID. But actually, when we make these little 1% movements forward and little tiny changes, those little drops in the ocean actually will make a difference long term. That, I think, timing is good, Lucinda.
Superb, Jay.
These are some of the references that I would highly recommend if you're interested in doing any more reading around clinician wellbeing. Like I said, if you could choose one book to buy or to read, I would read The Thriving Doctor, because it's got so many practical ideas on how we can actually improve our own wellbeing. It's very much written for the Australasian market, and so it's very accessible as opposed to some of the very American focused books. And if you had a book that you wanted to buy for every medicine, you know, every PGY1 that you look after, even though they say doctor, it could equally as relevant for all of our nursing and allied health team as well, then I would pick that book. Beyond Burnout is another book written by Susie McAlpine, who's again a New Zealand author. She's written more for the, I guess, for the corporate market rather than the medical market, but she writes very well about burnout and has some strategies for recovery from burnout from a personal perspective. But she also looks at it from a leadership perspective on how you can actually support a colleague or someone in your team that is experiencing burnout, or strategies that engage with if you're in a leadership position, that which actually will help you to ideally reduce or mitigate burnout in an organisation. And then take Chandler's book if you really want to get in depth. His book called with the Mayo Clinic called Strategies to Reduce Burnout is a very much an in-depth look into burnout and clinician wellbeing, which is a great book as well, and available in New Zealand too. And then the last one is some of you may well have read already, which is in a piece written by Charlotte Chambers, who actually writes very well for the ASMS on burnout within our SMO workforce.
Thanks, Joe. I've taken little notes. I mean, and I've seen it once before, and then I've listened to you again. And, you know, there's just some really good pointers there. I like the concept around that it's an occupational syndrome, because I think that removes some of the stigma around it, doesn't it? And that's part of the issue. I think we aren't very good about talking about things that might have some stigma attached to it. And then again, that realizing that there are things that we can control, but also we can be quite powerful as influencers. And then there is stuff that we just have nothing that we can do about. And actually being able to turn off from that, I think, is a useful concept. And then there's just so much there I think we can do tomorrow, actually. And in that feedback form, we always like to ask people, what could you do tomorrow? So, and I feel like sometimes that can galvanize some action. And I've certainly tried to put some stuff into place at my workplace, because I think that whole sense of belonging is key. And I think, you know, over the last couple of years with teams breaking into two, you know, trying not to cross over and trying not to catch COVID, or you're working from home more, you've just lost that interaction, haven't you? And that sense of belonging and community that we used to have, or was certainly better, I think, before COVID. Certainly can still be improved for sure. So yeah, there's just really simple things that you can put into place. Like we've tried to start meeting up at the pub again. Not that I am a huge advocate for drinking, anyone, but you know, you could meet at the park and go for a run. And just simple things to connect with each other. And it's exciting. So thanks so much, Joe, for your time today.
I'd offer one more piece of hope from a Te Whatu Ora perspective. is that from a workforce wellbeing perspective, there actually is work being done. So there is an advisory group that's been set up nationally, which has representation from clinicians. So there's now two clinician wellbeing leads, one of who is Osang Fee, who's an awesome anaesthetist that works up at Middlemore, and Lucille Wilkinson up north. So there's representation from senior clinicians, as well as HR, occupational health, health and safety, actually for the first time ever coming together at a national level as an advisory board for Te Whatu Ora to say, how do we approach workforce wellbeing? Now they, in their roles themselves, are very much like, look, we this is an advisory board to start with, we've got to get their roles established.
Oh, we've lost you, Joe. Lost you. Can you hear me?